What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network, New Books in History. I'm your host, R. Grant Kleiser. Joining me today is Dr. Pernille Ruge, who will be talking about her recent publication entitled Economies and the Reinvention of Empire, France in the Americas and Africa, circa 1750 to 1802, out now via Cambridge University Press. Dr. Ruge is an associate professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh, where she teaches courses on the Atlantic world, the French Revolution, European political economy, and the Enlightenment. She has also written about labor regimes and laborers in early modern port cities, 18th century abolition movements, and reform in both the French and Danish overseas empires. Dr. Ruge is also the founder of Pitt's Early Modern Worlds Initiative, which I encourage you all to check out online. Her new book, Economies and the Reinvention of Empire, charts the confluence and reciprocal impacts of ideas and policies espoused by political economists, colonial administrators, planters, and entrepreneurs to reform the French Empire in the second half of the 18th century. It also charts the key role of the economists, or physiocrats, in formulating new colonial doctrines that emphasized, among other things, agricultural development, free labor, and commercial liberalization, and the understudied continuities between the Ancien Régime reform movement and the imperial agenda espoused by French revolutionary republican voices and subsequent French imperial advocates. Dr. Ruge, congratulations on your work and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Grant, and also thank you so much for that generous introduction.
Our pleasure. So to begin with, most of our listeners may have some idea of who the physiocrats were, but for those who don't, could you please just briefly introduce this group and their key beliefs and perhaps explain why you use the term economists rather than the more popular physiocrats?
Yeah, thank you. So who were the economists? They were a rather eclectic group that sort of circulated among the upper elites in mid-18th century France. Usually we think of this group as having two co-founders, one being Dr. François Quinet, who was a doctor at court, and then the other one being the Marquis de Mirabeau, who liked himself to be sort of a political economist, and he was also a nobleman from the region of Aix-en-Provence. And then they had very quickly followers within the political administration, but also among some of the sort of the leading journalists of the time. And the reason why I opt for the term economist was because that was initially how they were known at the time. So this is the moment where there is an explosion in ideas of political economy. And they were sort of the group that were seen as the first group who thought of themselves as economists. They use in France the term economists. So I sort of also use that as a way of saying this is how they themselves thought of themselves initially. And then it's only later on in the 1760s that they start from talking about themselves as physiocrats and as and the doctrine they promoted as physiocracy.
And what's the origin of that term, physiocracy?
Yeah, people actually debate this a little back and forth. They see it as perhaps being promoted and coined by François Quinet, who looked back to sort of Greek, the Greek language, and he physiocracy basically means the rule of nature, right? And so they like to say that their political economy and their science of political economy had looked to the laws of nature and then basically looked at how they could be applied to civil society.
So much more of a natural law formulation in certain ways. And I know one of their key core beliefs is the belief in agriculture as this primary source of wealth for various nations. And that seems to me in some contrast to obviously manufacturers, especially from the Dutch and English perspective of manufacturing wealth and commercial wealth as being a prime source of wealth and power for nations. So is that a product of France's relative advantages in agriculture, or is that something the physiocrats thought was just inherently a more sound source of wealth and power?
Well, I mean, both François Quinet and the Marquis de Mirabeau are inspired by earlier political economists in France who sort of had this kind of agrarian political economy. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, of course, they're looking at their surroundings and they're responding to an emerging crisis of the French monarchy. And the fiscal crisis and financial crisis that we know so well for that sort of starts to dominate from the mid-18th century and then, of course, leads all the way down to the French Revolution. And they're on the lookout for a way to find out how we can respond with this through reform. And they look at France as basically an agricultural monarchy, not a monarchy that should be overwhelmingly catering to manufacturing interests. They want it to be a monarchy that embraces what they see as its sort of inherent strengths, which is agriculture.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. So how did you come to study this group in particular and this topic? What made you land on this topic?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think my whole interest in sort of combining French Enlightenment thought and the intellectual history of political economy with French colonial history on the one hand and sort of the history of old regime crisis and the French Revolution grew out of a fortunate combination of undergraduate classes that I took when I was an undergraduate student, where I had I was studying at the University of Paris, and I was fortunate to have three different classes in the same year that studied Caribbean history and the history of the Enlightenment and the history of the French Revolution. And I was allowed to combine those classes in writing my papers. So I got very interested in these ideas among Enlightenment thinkers of the role of slavery and arguments against slavery and for the abolition of slavery. And that, of course, I could combine with my studies on the French Caribbean and plantations, the plantation complex there, both within the French colonial empire, but also within other European colonial empires. And then, of course, when we started studying the French Revolution, I was very struck by how, at the time, how little space there was for discussions about the revolution in the French colonies. So I was able to combine my interest in ideas in the Caribbean with the paper I wrote for the French Revolution, which became on the Society for the Friends of the Black, which is this first French abolitionist society in France that argued for the abolition of the slave trade during the French Revolution and also ultimately the abolition of slavery in general. So that's how I initially got into this topic. And then getting to the political economists of the earlier period, so particularly the economists, so the physiocrats, was basically through reading some of the works that talked about the Société des Amis des Noirs. And a few of them sort of mentioned sort of throwaway comments about this sort of their ideas for free trade, their liberal ideas sort of were preceded in some ways by the ideas of the physiocrats. And then the literature wouldn't say more than that. So I just went, okay, this is interesting. Where can I learn more about these physiocrats? And then I was fortunate to then go into graduate school, and then I was able to then develop my whole graduate MPhil and then my doctoral thesis around that topic.
Yeah, it's amazing what those undergraduate classes can do and spark those questions and those books that you want to see that you end up writing or researching about. It's really great.
Yeah, it is. I think about it a lot when I now teach. You know, you wonder what kind of seeds you're planting in the minds of your students and what they're thinking about and the connections they draw.
and see those that literature 5-10 years down the road. That's really great. Mm-hmm. So speaking of you know, your book and the project and this sort of colonial and also physiocratic sort of confluence of ideas, your book mainly focuses on these reflections and ideas generated in and about the Îles du Vent, or Guadeloupe and Martinique and the surrounding islands, and Senegambia. Can you explain a little bit about why you focused on these two regions in particular, rather than, say, the more prominent or economically profitable colony of Saint-Domingue or modern-day Haiti?
Yeah, those are good questions. Thank you, first of all, for noticing that they are not actually so commonly studied for this period, mm-hmm. because that's also mm-hmm. how I felt.
Yeah,
But I came to those two regions because I started out with the ideas of the economists, right? And they are talking about these suggestions for how we can create or produce sugar and coffee and cotton and indigo and all those commodities that we get from the Caribbean through this horrific exploitation of slave labor from other regions where we don't have to tap into this kind of horrible labor system. And so they talk a lot about Africa, where they believe that there is possible to find a huge market for free labor, and they have a territory on which you can produce identical commodities, because some of these plants are already indigenous to Africa. So mm-hmm. then as I was reading about this, I sort of was thinking, where are they inspired? Where do they get their ideas from? And mm-hmm. sometimes they started sort of referencing histories of Africa, so in the form of natural histories that were really starting to emerge from around the 1750s, particularly with the publication of a botanist called Adanson, but also very quickly after many others who had traveled to the French trade stations in Africa, and then came back and wrote about their experiences and what they saw, and then I got very interested in these people who had then gone there, and I was thinking, okay, so maybe if I go beyond these kinds of natural histories to go into the colonial archives to see what's happening there, I will be able to find some interesting connections between what the physiocrats were writing and what was actually happening on the ground to better understand how their ideas are shaped. Mm-hmm. And so because I'm working on the French colonial empire, it's sort of like the natural for me to then go to the areas where the French actually were at the time, right? Mm-hmm. So they had their main trade stations and the island of Gorée in Senegambia, and also trade stations up the Senegal River. And then they had also Judah further down the coast in the Bight of Benin. But I sort of focused on the Senegambian region because the French saw that as sort of their main stronghold in West Africa. So that was the African component. And the other side of the story, so the Caribbean, was because, of course, they're also writing almost against what is already going on in the French Caribbean. And there I knew through studying the physiocrats and their networks that they were deeply inspired by people who had held administrative positions in the Île du Vent, so at Guadeloupe and Martinique. And as I write about in my book, particularly the brother of one of the co-founders of physiocracy, the Chevalier de Mirabeau, who is the brother of the Marquis de Mirabeau. He was governor of Guadeloupe in the mid-1750s, so early to mid-1750s. And then, of course, one of the main writers that were recruited by Quigny and Mirabeau, his name is Le Mercier de la Rivière, initially was an intendant at Martinique in the 50s in the Île du Vent as well. And so they really were inspired by the people who grew out of that context rather than Saint-Domingue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that Mirabeau brother correspondence is so wealthy and so rich in their correspondence to each other. And I really enjoy that sort of perspective and that question of, you know, where do these economists get their ideas from rather than just looking at their ideas. So moving to the meat of your work, your first chapter sort of sets the stage in terms of the French Empire and French imperial political economy in the mid-18th century. And you've hinted at this a bit thus far, but could you tell us a bit in general terms of what France's colonial economy looked like, especially before the Seven Years' War?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was sort of set up already in the early 18th century in terms of its trade and commercial policy in these letters, lettres patentes, or letters patent from 1717 and 1727. And within those, it's set up in the way that the French port cities, some of the key ones being Nantes and Bordeaux and Le Havre, Marseille, and so these places have the exclusive and privilege of trading with the colonies or with the French slave stations, right? Mm-hmm. And so within the Atlantic sphere, the political economy of the French colonial empire within that sphere is really governed by these letters patent. And it also immediately, therefore, makes the colonists feel that they are in an inferior position to the French metropolitan merchants, because they in turn have to buy everything from these merchants, but also sell their cash crops, so their sugar and then their coffee to French merchants. And they have to also purchase the commodities that they provide.
Yeah. So yeah, so the exclusif is obviously is a the dominant political economic system at the time in France, and then it seems like in most empires, the Seven Years' War from 1756 to 1763 sort of makes all these empires reformulate their political economies and their way of empire. So could you talk a little bit about how the Seven Years' War affected these debates and discussions of France's colonial regime and its political economy?
Yeah, I think what really happened with the war is that the Seven Years' War puts all these European powers under extreme stress, both from a local perspective of the various people in the colonies, because suddenly they can't actually get access to the provisions and sources of provision that they usually had through because of warfare and trade barriers and so on. And at the same time, at the metropolitan level, merchants starting to fear that now because of this, there's all this additional contraband trade going on in the colonies through intercolonial trade that the colonists feel they have to do because they don't have access to their normal supply lines. These kinds of problems weren't new. Of course, there's always been contraband trade going on, and we also see in the correspondence of the Mirabeau brothers, which is, you know, sort of from 1753 into 1754 and 1755, that there's lots of contraband trade, and there's lots of tension between planter interest in the colonies and metropolitan merchants. But what happens in the war is that these tensions just exacerbated tremendously, right? And so it leaves particularly metropolitan merchants and politicians increasingly fearing that if we don't deal with this pressure in some way, we actually can end up losing these colonies. And that's precisely what starts to happen as we get into the Seven Years' War, because we see first the French colony of Guadeloupe capitulate to the British forces during the war. And then a few years after, we see the same thing happening again in Martinique, where Martinique then in 1762 capitulates to the British as well. And so the French really fear that if we don't start to undertake immediate reform and deal with this issue, actually even before the war comes to an end, we can end up losing what some of our most valuable possessions in terms of our economy. Because of it, because of the existing system of the exclusive. And that really is replicated in some of the other colonial empires. And we see, therefore, that actually reform is not just a French thing that happens in the aftermath of the Seven Years' War, but it is actually a broader trans-European phenomenon.
And is that fear of losing these colonies due to potential revolutions or revolts because of the political economy, or opportunities for foreigners to conquer those islands?
Yeah, so that's interesting because that, of course, depends on what colony they're looking at, right? Because they actually have this discussion, not just the Mirabeau brothers, but more broadly, there's this sense we're going to lose the colonies. But as the Mirabeau, who's in the colonies, says, well, yes, we are potentially, but it depends in what way you're thinking about this, because the Caribbean colonies that are sort of built around a monocrop culture of just purely producing sugar, they can't sustain themselves without some metropole. So what they are on the lookout for is the metropole that they feel can supply it with their essential needs and with enough labor so they can continue to produce their sugar and their cotton and their coffee and so on. So for Martinique and Guadeloupe, it's not really independence that they seek. They just seek a better supplier and a better market, right? And for them, it looks like the English are actually doing a better job. So they want to come, they're quite happy to capitulate to the British because they think they're going to supply them better than the French. But at the same time, then you have the 13 colonies where you actually have an interesting parallels, right? Because there, this whole discussion about whether they will also rise up in revolt is more about whether they're actually going to seek independence. And because the 13 colonies are able to sustain themselves through the production of agriculture and sort of like budding manufacturing, the discussion is that they are actually going to immediately seek independence or ultimately seek independence. And potentially they will then inspire these other colonies to join them.
Yeah. So in response to this crisis, this perceived crisis, what did the physiocrats propose?
So they propose a number of things. They have sort of with one eye to the Americas and another eye then to Africa. What they propose in terms of sort of at least prolonging the French relationship with its Caribbean colonies, because when they start actually publishing, France has lost its holdings on North American main continent, so they've lost Canada, right? And so they say, well, how can we then at least, if we can't forever preserve our bond with the Caribbean colonies, how can we prolong it for as long as possible? And there they say, we actually have to completely rethink how we think about these colonies. We shouldn't think of them as territories that the metropole should just exploit. We shouldn't think of them as, and the phrasing they use, as farms of the metropole, right? Where they're just there to produce for us and for our merchants to get rich. Instead, we should think about them as provinces that are similar to provinces domestically. Mm-hmm. And so they actually want to change the whole vocabulary and the way of thinking about empire, right? They want to move away from this way of thinking of them as colonies that are inferior to the metropole, to thinking about them as having a territorially equal status to the provinces at home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely an important transition in the mentality of empire as well. In terms of other commercial liberalization and labor regimes, what are some of their ideas? Or do those ideas come out of the war, or are those sort of ideas formulating before and then get exacerbated after the war as well?
So what particularly the physiocrats are proposing at this
point?
So what they're proposing in terms of trade, and you see this actually coming out first in the writings of the Marquis de Mirabeau before he and François Quinet founds the physiocratic doctrine. He suggests freer trade, right? So he wants to have imperial free trade, so free trade between the colonies, but also potentially with other colonies and other empires. So he's promoting already their free trade. And that's, of course, a perspective that also grows out of his discussions with his brother in the colonies. So you can say this whole idea of promoting free trade is something that many of the planters have been asking for way before that, right? And then it's taken up by these political economists and sort of molded into a theory of free trade. So they're promoting freer trade, and it's something that they also promoted for the provinces at home. What they are so famous for, the physiocrats, is that they promoted the free circulation of grain within France and even internationally, right? So they promote these free trade policies at home, and now they want to extend them to the colonies as well. And they do this because they think that through the free circulation of grain or free circulation of sugar or coffee or indigo or anything else that's generated from the earth, from agriculture, we will be able to find the best price. And the best price is the one, if you only have one single land tax, that you should make sure you find, so that when you tax grain or sugar or coffee or agricultural production, you will have the highest revenues. And this high revenue will be enough of a source for the crown to be able to thrive and build up the France itself and its colonies. So that's the whole idea, right? That's why they emphasize free trade. But they also think that actually to be able to produce this agriculture and sugar and coffee, you shouldn't use slave labor, because they see that as a perverse form of labor that isn't actually as productive as free labor, because the incentive is different. So they also say we should move away from the use of slave labor towards free labor. So they actually argue three things. They argue for a shift in the colonies away from the use of slave labor towards free labor. And then they argue for a liberalization of trade. And then they argue for this whole reconceptualization of a colony, so that in the minds of the French, they shouldn't think of it as inferior territories, but as territories that are equal to territories at home. And then they use this phrase, overseas provinces.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. And then one particular effect you note is the establishment of the Chambre Mi-Partier d'Agriculture et du Commerce on Martinique. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about this specific reform and its lasting consequences and effects in Martinique, and then perhaps in the French Empire as well.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's that's actually, it's interesting, because it's kind of the reform that grows, one of the reforms that grows out of the Seven Years' War. It happens that already during the war is that the French crown is so nervous that the planters in Martinique and Guadeloupe and Saint-Domingue are going to rise up in rebellion or defect to the English, that they want to give them something, right? Throw them a bone right away. So they set up these chambers of agriculture and commerce institutions at the local level that will allow planters and local merchants to deliberate for their needs, and to write reports and reforms and proposals for how to improve the local situation. And then they get a representative to sit in the Council of Commerce in Paris alongside representatives from France's various cities. So the reform itself is in some ways a step towards recognizing the needs of the colonies and giving them some a sort of like parity with the cities by having them now giving them now a seat within the Council of Commerce, where France and its commercial policies are debated and discussed. At the local level, though, they also in these chambers then have first, they're going to have four merchants and then four planters who can then sit and deliberate. And what I do in my book with that is to say, wow, this is actually a wealth of information about how these people at the local level engaged with the political economic debates at the metropole and tried to shape and influence reform through this engagement and through their ability to suddenly communicate both to local governors and also to decision makers in Paris and at Versailles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's notable too, I think, that this is happening during the war. They're seeing Guadeloupe fall to the British, and this is a sort of a wartime crisis that they're responding to immediately, but then obviously has these repercussions, as you mentioned in your book, that lasts much farther beyond the war itself. So moving across to the Atlantic, what are some of France's designs for Senegal or Senegambia, and why did this region transition in some French minds from a traditional source of enslaved labor to a potential colony in its own right?
Yeah, so, you know, the French, it has to be said, and particularly the French crown, it sticks to its policy of just looking at its territories in West Africa as a way to find laborers for its plantation complex in the Caribbean, right? So at the real high official level, they don't start to see Senegal or Senegambia as a region for French colonial expansion. What happens is that we have these political economists that start seeing it that way. And then we also have governors who were sent to West Africa and colonial officials who were sent to West Africa to Senegal, Senegambia, more broadly, that starts to look at opportunities there. And they, of course, look at this well aware that there is a growing crisis in the Americas where France's grip on its colonies there are appearing more and more fragile, more and more vulnerable. So they start thinking, well, can we think of an alternative? Can we found of new regions for colonial expansion and exploitation? And they look at Africa and they say, wow, there's this whole continent that mm-hmm. Europeans haven't really started colonizing yet, but we absolutely should do that, right? So that's what they say. And then, of course, part of this to say they look at the African population and they say, why on earth are we sending all these people across the Atlantic through the and letting them go through the horrors of the Middle Passage, right, and enslaving them in the colonies and subjecting them to these high degrees of violence there, when actually we can potentially cultivate the same things here, right? Mm-hmm. And so so governors that are sent to Gorée and the surroundings there to try to preserve and build up the French slave trade there, they on the side start to propose all these projects for colonization. And of course that resonates very, very well with the things that the physiocrats are also promoting at this time, and they are actually very much in dialogue with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, I think that's a really fascinating transition from empire that obviously has implications for the future French Empire, which we can talk about. And the traditional sort of answers that I received of why Europe hadn't tried to colonize Africa in the same way did the Americas was the power of African polities and diseases that were more virulent in Africa to Europeans. So are these conditions ameliorated somewhat in the later 18th century, or are the physiocrats just a little bit more confident that France can actually accomplish this?
No, I mean, if we look at what's happening on the ground, and I actually show this in the book, the French are completely at the mercy of local African rulers. That's for sure. And we also see many of the administrators that are there, they can't stay for a long time because, of course, they're subject to disease, and many of them also die because, for the reasons that we know so well. So those obstacles are really, they're very real. But there, there are many smaller islands at the mouth of the Senegal River or along the coast, what they're proposing initially is basically to focus on these islands or the coastal territories where they feel that the climate is more amenable to Europeans. Yeah.
Yeah. So can you speak to how these reforms and visions were reflected in Republican imperial agendas during the French Revolution in the 1790s?
Sure. I'm going to say one thing first, if that's okay with you, because you were talking about obstacles to these reforms at the time. One of the things that I show in the book is that it isn't just the power of African polities or disease that is preventing the French from doing it. One of the things that I was quite struck to find in my research is the fact that it's really also the crown that is trying to block these attempts, because you have on the ground French officials that are actually undertaking this and they're trying to experiment with this, right? And several of them are trying to set up plantations and they have modest success, but some success with cultivating some of the crops that they also find in the Americas. And we see in reports from the minister, be it Choiseul or some of the later ministers, time and time again, that they're trying to make them close down these experiments, because what they don't want to see, even if they say, okay, so you have this success, but we don't want you to compete with our colonies in the Caribbean. We don't want that to risk that you can produce this cheaper than what we're doing in the Caribbean. And of course, it's because they themselves are deeply invested in the plantation complex in the Americas. So an added layer that sort of prevents a full-on sort of a experimentation in Senegambia at this period is also that there's actually strong resistance from the very top, even though you have people on the ground and also capitalist interests in France and growing intellectual communities that are arguing that this is the way forward. So this is just to say, because it allows me to pivot to your question about, so why is this taken up during the French Revolution? Because what, of course, happens in the French Revolution is that the French are actually no longer able to continue their plantation complex in the Caribbean, because mm-hmm. you have the slave uprising on Saint-Domingue. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, once it's not just Saint-Domingue, you, of course, also have slave rebellions on Martinique and Guadeloupe and other parts of the French colonies with the revolution. But the big one is really Saint-Domingue. And at that moment in time, all the people who have benefited from and invested in and profited from the colonial commerce with the Caribbean, they realize that we can't potentially, this won't last forever, right? That we actually are losing this. And then as war breaks out in 1792-93, as we know from the literature that studies the abolition of slavery, the French actually have to go in on Saint-Domingue and abolish slavery, in part so that they can recruit the enslaved as soldiers in the army to fight against the British. Mm-hmm. And this is happening at a time where France, of course, is also now proclaiming itself a republic. Mm-hmm. And as they do, they then feel they can divest themselves of this reputation of being being promoting slavery. Even though slavery continued well into the French Revolution, they can now sort of live up to the principles that we found in the Declaration of the Rights of Man, the first article, and then say that it is a republican principle to extend freedom and liberty and equality to our colonies. And they do this with the abolition of slavery, then, which they proclaim in February 1794. But with that, they are also basically admitting we don't have the plantation complex anymore. At least we have undercut the main component of that, which is slave labor. And so at that point, these alternative ideas and projects that have been circulating and partially experimented with on the ground, particularly in West Africa, and this idea of elevating the colonies to overseas provinces, and now they switch it to overseas departments, they sort of are integrated into the Republican imperial agenda, because it's potentially the only way that they can continue their imperial missions here, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why, even though it had existed for such a long time, and we've seen it grow out of sort of a much earlier imperial crisis, it's the crisis with the Haitian Revolution that makes it possible for the people who promoted it for a long time to suddenly see their projects and ideas elevated to the level of official policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it takes that crisis to open up that possibility, definitely. And so you talk so much and in such great depth about this confluence of ideas from the colonies and the metropole, inspiring these ideas and these reforms that obviously meets against resistance, and that resistance sort of conditions responses and this sort of flow of ideas back and forth. And I'm wondering if in your research you saw any cross-imperial connections and inspirations. Were physiocrats corresponding with British and Dutch and Spanish political economists as well, that you saw that was notable?
Yeah. Thank you so much for that. Yeah, there are lots of cross-imperial connections here. And one of the things that was so much fun in doing the research for this book is that I was also able to dive into British archives and Danish archives. And mm-hmm. and also sort of read a little bit about what was going on there. And there, the project, for instance, about thinking about colonial expansion in West Africa based on what they call or refer to as free labor and moving away from the use of slave labor was not particularly confined to the French, right? You see similar projects going on almost in competition with the French projects on the ground. Mm-hmm. And the people who are experimenting with it, the French people, they actually write to the Crown and say, we really better get going on this because the English are starting to think about it and do it. And we also see the Danes or the Swedish and so on. Right. So there is this, there are these cross-imperial connections to trace. Mm-hmm. And the same thing for the political economists that are writing. So the first time that I see one of the political economists that are going to join the officially join the Frisiocrats, his name is the Abbé Robot. Before he joins the Frisiocrats, he works for the Journal of Commerce that reviews writings that are produced in Amsterdam or in London or other parts of Europe, and then he translates it into French if it needs mm-hmm. translating, and then he comments on it. And one of the pieces that he comments on is a piece produced by Malachy Postlewaite, who was an Englishman who worked from the English Africa Company and had written about why the English should attack and conquer Senegal during the Seven Years' War. But he also wrote other pieces about, you know, potentially colonizing Africa and creating plantations there. And so Robot takes and translates this piece into French and starts discussing it. And then he further develops this idea by connecting it to the ideas of the Marquis de Mirabeau about exporting civilization to Africa. This is an idea that Mirabeau articulates already in 1756. And then they slowly start to sort of merge these different strands of thought together to craft their own vision. And of course, that's inspired a lot also by what's happening outside of France and in intellectual communities elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fascinating that those transfer of ideas between and across empires. Now, so you talked about these reforms and visions having real cachet and influence in the French Revolution, but could you speak to sort of more contemporary times or the quote unquote second French Empire? How did this physiocratic vision and these ancien regime reform efforts condition these post-Napoleonic imperial designs?
Yeah, thank you. Well, it was a question I asked myself, and I first had, I think, a rather naive response to it. So I'm a historian of particularly sort of the old regime and its colonies, and not so much about what happens later on. But I was well aware of how we think of what historians refer to as the second colonial empire mm-hmm. as often being about the mission to civilize. And this mm-hmm. whole idea, particularly during Third Republic, of exporting French civilization to Africa and how that was sort of the ideology that legitimized their imperial mission there later on, right? And I was thinking, wow, that's very interesting. There are clear connections here between the two. Why is it that these early ideas about exporting civilization to Africa isn't connected more clearly to what happens later on? And why is it exactly that we constantly prevent ourselves from speaking across the two colonial empires, so the way we think about them as an early modern French colonial empire, what we call the first colonial empire, which is then ending more or less with the French Revolution, and then this rise of a second colonial empire. And we are sort of historians that are operating in two camps. We don't really speak much to each other. mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so what, you know, my thinking of, so how are these connected? And initially, as I said, I had a rather naive response to it, thinking, well, they're clearly connected because they have a very similar language in thinking about what the French could do for Africa by exporting its civilization there, and how then Africa should attain civilization through its production of cash crop commodities and raw materials, which France could then purchase in exchange for manufactured goods, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But at the same time, what I discovered as I started reading more about the later periods, there were also really strong differences. So I'm not trying to say that it's exactly the same. There are many, many differences too. But what I realized was that what I saw as innovation in the first French colonial empire, so these ideas that we've been discussing today, were happening alongside, as I explained in the book, this more conventional or all-pervasive approach to colonial empire that were based on the plantation complex, based on this kind of trade privileges and exclusive commercial rights to the metropole, and based on particular laws for the colonies that didn't apply in the metropole. But actually, what I realized that the second colonial empire had lots of these elements too going on, right? So there, continuities in the same sense that many of the traditional and old law things that we find in the first colonial empire researched and underpinned some of the things we see in the second colonial empire, for instance, with what they call, referred to as the Pacte Familial, which is still, or Pacte Colonial, which is still this kind of the colonies and the metropole should trade together and only with each other, right? But then what we see as sort of novelty and innovation in the colonial empire also in some ways structure French imperial expansion, for instance, through this idea of civilization, but also in the struggle between France and its what it refers to in the later periods as its old colonies, so the vieilles colonies being Martinique and Guadeloupe, and this struggle between the metropole and these colonies in finding a relationship that sort of works for both of them, that actually ends up being what it is today, which is when they think of these colonies as France's overseas departments, right? So they are now conceptualized as overseas departments, right? So there are really interesting continuities between this idea of thinking about what the physiocrats promoted as overseas provinces and the way this struggle towards thinking about the colonies as overseas departments. And there are interesting continuities between the way they were thinking about France's, or how it saw France as being able to potentially civilize Africa, and how the Third Republic were thinking about its mission in particularly big parts of Western Northern Africa, right? But I also want to emphasize that there are really also huge differences here, and that continuity is an interesting concept to work with, because it can operate both in terms of novelty and in terms of sort of more all-pervasive elements of colonialism.
Yeah, so based on the last couple of questions and the book in general, I think you do a really great job at intervening in two major topics or themes that seems like most 18th century French colonial historians at least should comment on, which is some of the origins of the French Revolution and French revolutionary ideology and designs. And like you just talked about, this quote-unquote transition from the first French Empire and the quote-unquote second French Empire. I'm wondering if you were always sort of confident that you wanted to make interventions in both of these major topics.
I was probably overconfident. I have to say, I was probably overconfident because I was far more at home in the first colonial empire, and I thought I knew much more about what was going on in the second colonial empire. So, as I say, I think I was overconfident, but I knew that I wanted to create a dialogue between the two fields. I knew that I was seeking to do that, right? But I think what came out in the book, hopefully, is a more humble suggestion than the one I had initially in my mind. But also, I think I also wanted to show new things about the French Revolution, which as a connector in some ways, right? It's not a point of departure for developments that happened in the second colonial colonial empire, and it's not this new starting point. It's also just basically continuing all these efforts that were going on the margins and among intellectual and political communities in France during the old regime, right? And and so it's about understanding how continuity and rupture and innovation and persistence and tradition are constantly interlock, you know, through historical processes.
Yeah, and a mixture of confidence and humility sometimes is good to have there. That's great. What's a particularly surprising or unexpected thing that you learned from this study?
I think, like many of us, when we go to the archives, we don't know what to expect. And so before I went, I had been reading a lot of the published work by political economists, and I was quite well aware of their discourse and their vocabulary. And I wanted to be able to sort of understand that and have a good sense of that before I went in to read the colonial archives. Mm-hmm. And I had hoped that I would find resonances in there, but I wasn't at all sure of it. Mm-hmm. So I think that when I went through boxes of colonial material, and I found, you know, either like actual phrases that are taken out from text in these colonial documents, or I found concepts in these colonial comments documents, I'm sure you could have seen me sort of jump from my chair in the archives.
Exactly.
It's one of those moments where you look around and you're so happy and everybody else is staring at you thinking, what's going on?
Exactly.
So, the fact that there were these really clear connections between what we think of as sort of like an intellectual canon that has been published, and all of these pieces of documents in the form of memoirs and reports and letters, to me that was very exciting. And while I had hoped for it, it was very nice to see those resonances in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. So finally, as the last question, we always like to ask, what are you planning on next? What are any projects or publications on the horizon for you?
Yeah, so part of what I do is to continue my work on the French colonial empire by looking at other colonies than Martinique and Guadeloupe. So I have some of the documents from the Chambers of Agriculture and Commerce from some of the other colonies, and I'm interested in looking at how what they have to say about economic reform and the kind of language they use. But I'm actually starting to move into whole new project, which is not about the French colonial empire, but about the Danish colonial empire. Mm. And so my next project is going to be about, I sort of have a working title, which is A Gateway to Empire. And it's going to explore the 18th century French colonial empire, but predominantly through the eyes of the foreigners that moved through it, either personally or invested their capital in it. So it's going to be this kind of trans-imperial history of the French colonial empire.
Wow, that sounds fascinating, and very much looking forward to seeing that in print. Thank you so much, Dr. Rui, for this wonderful discussion and for your time today. Economistes and the Reinvention of Empire is out now via Cambridge University Press. And for the New Books Network, this is our Grant Kleiser saying thank you and see you next time.